now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and welcome to The Game, your audio analysis of the week in football. This week, I'm joined by Rory Smith, a rather ill-sounding Tony Cascarino, and, of course, from Rippenden, it's Mr. Ollie Kay. Later on, we'll be discussing empowerment and controversy at White Hart Lane. But first, we go to Villa Park. Ollie, I feel stupid even asking this question because I feel like we say this like every week, but some pretty remarkable stats involving United. I think it's 17 games they've played this season. 10 times they've had to come from behind. They've made up 15 points in that run. Is there any logical, rational reason for this? Because they seem to be such outliers, and it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, it's not such an outlier when you consider that Manchester City seem to be doing something similar. And I would say that in the case of both City and United, there's a real vulnerability about them this season in the way they're defending. But it always seems like the earlier teams score against them, the more they sort of are in danger of being swamped in the closing stages. We saw it with City yesterday against Tottenham. We certainly saw it on Saturday with United swamping Aston Villa in the closing stages. I think teams just panic when they lead against them. United never panic, and the teams that are defending against them sort of almost seem to succumb to this feeling that it's going to happen, and you know, even on days when United don't hit top form, it does seem to happen.
Take a lead, sit back, counterattack, kill the game. Isn't this sort of a legitimate way of playing against United when you have the lead?
It is, yeah, and that's why teams do it. Too often, teams just cede the initiative. They seem to sort of almost expect that wave to come from United, and then they're sort of surprised when it does.
But why does it happen?
Well, I think it happens because it's happened so much. Basically, it's kind of this sort of self-fulfilling cycle that United, everyone expects United to come back from 2-0, 2-1 down to win. So they do, and teams kind of acquiesce to their fate. And you can see it two ways. You can either see it as United attacking brilliance, or you can see it that teams are kind of, waiting for this to happen. And I think both kind of exist, both are true.
Ollie, let's talk Chicharito, because obviously, you know, that's one of the ways you can read the game is that's really what changed it. At halftime, he comes on for Ashley Young. They move things around. Wayne Rooney starts sitting deeper in his new number 10 position, as some people like to call it. And this guy goes and scores what everybody here calls a hat trick. What, you know, some of us old school people say that if the ball comes in, goes in off Ron Flaher's backside and was not going into the goal, probably shouldn't have counted. But regardless, changes the game. I want to ask you about Chicharito because, we talk about all the strikers he has and whatever else, but we both know that in August, I guess, people started knocking on his door because they did the maths, and it's Van Persie, it's Rooney, it's Kagawa, it's Welbeck, plus the wingers, of course. He stuck around. Sir Alex wouldn't let him go. And now he's rewarding him. Are you surprised by how it's turned out?
I was slightly surprised by how it didn't turn out so well for him last season, where he seemed to have a bit of a block in his development after that brilliant first season. His form last season, there were goals here and there, but there was never the sort of persistent threat that there had been previously. And it seems like he's got back into the groove over the last few weeks in particular. His record this season seems to be better, particularly coming off the bench. And I mean, his performance on Saturday, it's an understatement to say it was game changing. He was brilliant. His movement was fantastic for the goals, and I mean, obviously the marking was particularly slack for the third one. But it's he has got everything in his locker to be the sort of Solskjaer type. Who comes off the bench to score, or who sort of comes in, does a great job for one game, moves out again for two games, comes back in again. He seems to be a player who adjusts very well to that type of role, and I think that is the type of thing that, you know, when we talk about teams that have four great strikers or whatever, it's essential that at least one or two of them are willing to play that squad game, and he is seemingly willing to do it and very good at it.
Cass, I want to ask you about that, because at that age, sort of 23, 24, that he's approaching, is, you know, is that what you want to do? Do you want to be a Solskjaer type? Or, you know, it's a classic sort of, you know, big fish, small pond situation, possibly, were he to leave. But I don't know. I'm just wondering. I mean, how did you approach it? When you were playing, did you find yourself in teams where, you know, later in your career, perhaps when you were, you know, a squad striker, did you accept it because you were like, yeah, these guys clearly are better than me? Mm. But then maybe when you were younger, you said, well, if I'm not going to play, I kind of want to go somewhere else.
Well, first of all, we have hated Gab, you know, that role that he's been given. And I touched on with Rory over the last few weeks about Dzeko doing the same with Man City, as you end up becoming a bit of a super sub. I mean, I had scored 6 out of 7 internationals at one stage and knew I was going to play second fiddle to Noel Quinn at international level. And it was difficult because you just knew that, like probably Hernandez does, that he's not going to nudge out Rooney and Van Persie. That's not going to happen. And also, Fergie looks at him and thinks, what a fabulous game changer I've got. I've got a guy I can know I can sling on. I know he can turn around a match for me. And that makes it even more unfortunate in some ways for Hernandez, because now he's found a role where he seems to fit perfectly. I mean, this super sub thing, lots of clubs love to have them. United have had it before, and Oliver just touched on the Schalke, which is a perfect, you know, sort of comparison. But I looked at sort of, you know, maybe Chelsea are hoping that Victor Moses might do that. You know, Dzeko has certainly done it for Man City, and you look at him and you just think he's too good. I think he's a fabulous striker. He's one of them. He never stops moving. So he's very hard to mark. He will get all types of goals as well. If you take his third goal, it's all about getting half a yard, getting across a body, gets his head on it and buries it in the bottom corner, because he's a very good header of the ball. And that's what, you know, that's what's going to be frustrating for him, because I just can't see him long term getting down a firm fixture in the team, unfortunately, for him.
So that being the case then, Roy, I mean, and Hernandez is a bit unusual in the sense that he's an intelligent guy. He's got some university as well. He comes from a certain background. Hey, do you think he's going to continue accepting a walk-on part in Sir Alex's war rather than a lead role in some gilded Europa League cage?
You've been working on that, haven't you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's nice. I find the psychology of a substitute really interesting. As Tony touches on, it must be really hard for Hernandez or Dzeko or whoever to know that they're doing really well, that they're having this incredible impact, but whatever they do, they're typecast and they're kind of condemned to exist. You know, that they will not play, they won't start the next game, they won't start, you know, they're not. Hernandez is never going to convince Ferguson to say, right, you know what, that money I spent on Van Persie, going to write that off.
1 second, I know we talk about Dzeko, we'll talk about City a bit, but I think Dzeko's perhaps slightly different in the sense that, A, Manchester City's manager isn't some monolithic figure who will be there forever and ever. B, Dzeko is a little bit older. C, Dzeko makes a hell of a lot more money than Chicharito makes. And also, Dzeko's been a starter. He's been a superstar in Europe.
Yeah, and so that's the difference. That Hernandez, I think, certainly for the next year, couple of years, will probably be more than happy to play that sort of Solskjaer role at United. There will come a point, I would have thought, when he'll think, do you know what, I want to be playing regularly, I want to be a first-team footballer. I think that every player reaches that point when they want to kind of make that leap between young player, young prospect, and regular starter, regular star. And that will come to Hernandez. I mean, the question is, and the issue is, I guess, for him, is the law of being at United in any capacity whatsoever bigger than being a starter for maybe a slightly lower tier club? Or could he be a starter at another club challenging for the title?
Would you rather be a Solskjaer or a Shearer, I guess, is what
Yeah, that's kind of the debate, yeah.
Let's say, enough United talk. Let's talk Philip. Okay, Paul Lambert obviously had an up-and-down start. He had a difficult departure from Norwich, but when you look at this, when I saw this, the starting lineup for this game, and I just asked myself, how many of these guys were Villa players even a year ago, were Villa regulars a year ago? This team's really been turned inside out. Is that something that, I mean, if you want to be really cynical, you say Lambert's doing this to give himself an alibi and he's playing the kids because nobody will boo the kids and whatever. Or you could say Lambert actually has a real plan here and it's going to take some time to get to fruition.
Well, it seems to be slightly sort of similar to the Brendan Rodgers thing at Liverpool where, you know, where Rodgers is playing a lot of younger players. He's, you know, the squad looks a lot younger, looks a lot thinner, looks a lot hungrier perhaps, but there's an awful lack of experience. And, I mean, you know, one thing both clubs have got in common is American ownership. American ownership seems to be about keeping costs down. Obviously, there's a value thing, but there seems to be a great desire to keep costs down and not invest hugely in aging players on bigger salaries, which I think they've both had.
Before, sorry, Ollie, they did that before, of course, when Martin O'Neill was there, and we saw how well that worked out.
That's what I was saying. You know, they both had their fingers burnt on that. They're both going in a different direction. And I think a lot of people, a lot of fans of both of those clubs are very encouraged by it and think, you know, it's a great healthy thing to be doing. And it certainly looks progressive, but you wonder to what extent it's about not investing rather than about getting value. Villa, I think, you know, you look at them the last few seasons, it's just looked incredibly stale at Villa Park. Everything has looked stale since perhaps the final month of O'Neill's time. And it's, you know, they've gone in a different direction with younger, hungrier, more energetic, completely unproven players. And, you know, there are pros and cons to that approach. I think we saw the pros in the first half and the cons in the second.
There's no question that
is that true, Roy? Did they lose because you got Loughton and West? I mean, I thought we'd be praising somebody for playing, you know, young British players. Yeah, it seems to be important to you lot when you guys do that.
It's not important to me.
Not you, it's the generic you lot.
But the Lambert's not doing that because he wants to. He didn't go into Villa Park and say, do you know what, I really want to sign that lad from Sheffield United. That's exactly what I want to do. He's doing it because Randy Lerner has effectively pulled out of Aston Villa in real terms. He will not invest in the squad. There's an interesting point with, and I don't have an answer to the question on American owners. Obviously, FSG at Liverpool, Randy Lerner both own American sports franchises where the wage bills will be massively higher than they are in the Premier League, especially Aston Villa, even under Martin O'Neill. Why are they so terrified of the wages in English football? I don't understand.
Would you like me to answer that?
If you could, yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah. So in American sports, you have it's a completely different business model. So they would have a salary cap, which, so they know the wages are only going to be, they know their costs going in cannot be over a certain amount. And they also have an enormous TV contract, and so they'll know that they'll get this much coming in and they'll get this much coming in from season ticket sales. The only variable really over the course of a season for them, for whether a franchise makes or loses money, is going to be a little marginal amount related to attendance and a little bit related to merchandising.
Okay,
that's all it is. In England, it's very different.
Surely, in the Premier League or any European football league, it's not a complicated business. You must roughly know what your income's going to be, certainly from telly and from season ticket sales, roughly. I agree that there's not a salary cap, but there's no reason to asset strip a squad the way that Aston Villa have without reinvesting that money. I think Lambert is a brilliant manager. I think tactically he's really alert. I really like him. He's very promising. I think of that crop of managers, he's the best. But there's a limit to what he can achieve with a squad made up of young players, some of whom are relatively talented, none of whom are going to sort of set the world alight, I don't think. And built on a shoestring. It's just not. So he's not. He deserves praise for sort of competing with Manchester United with a team of young players. He doesn't deserve praise for playing young players. He has to play young players. He doesn't have a choice.
I had this experience a while back where I wrote about Everton and Everton's longer-term future, and all these people said, oh, you're crazy. No, because Everton are a massive club, massive this, massive that, and massive my ass. But I look at this, and the real economics of football today, I'd argue that Villa, in terms of catchment area and demographics, probably has potentially a lot more potential than a club like Everton. Am I wrong there? Who has the brighter future?
I don't know. I'm not sure, Gab.
Well, you're from there, Rory. Back me up.
Birmingham.
I mean,
the affluent city.
Sorry?
Birmingham isn't an especially affluent city.
Right. So whereas Liverpool is Monte Carlo. Okay.
Gab, so many clubs, you know, decisions, what they make at board level determine their future, and you've got to have the right people. Everton have done very, very well for me in what they've achieved, because they've done it, you know, in a very...
We're
very
not going forward. I don't care about who's done well in the past, okay?
Gab,
I'm asking, going forward, where's the...
You don't know that.
Sorry?
The future's an illusion.
The future's...
Ooh, Chas, that's nice.
Oh, he's good.
That is
right.
Nice.
On that metaphysical note, I bow out and move on to Manchester City, where the future is very real. I was hoping not to talk about Mario Balotelli because he didn't play in this game and he was in the stands, but because the cameras had to show him with his big hoodie and linger on him for a long, long time, I need to get this out of the way. Ollie, you're the best informed on everything out of all of us. Is there some secret story about Mario Balotelli and why he didn't start? Why Razak was on the bench?
There usually is.
What is it?
Come out, but I'm not aware at the time that at the time of recording this. I know that it was certainly not an injury, certainly not illness, probably not tactical. It was, there's an issue where they didn't want him to be in the 18-man squad, and they wanted Scott Sinclair and Abdul Razak to be in there ahead of him. And David Platt was saying, oh, well, we can only find 18 players. Well, it's been very rare for Balotelli not to be amongst those 18 players and for there not to be four strikers among those 18 players. So, you know my views on Balotelli. I don't think he's worth the aggro. And I think
we know your views. We don't need to hear them again.
Mario Balotelli is addicted to jigsaws and was up until 6 in the morning doing a jigsaw on the morning of the game.
A jigsaw puzzle or actual like woodworking?
No, a jigsaw puzzle. He likes 1,000 pieces. That's the actual story.
Not the power tools.
He doesn't like power tools at all.
No. Okay.
Cass, let's move on to you since we've exhausted our Balotelli quota here. Spurs take the lead, but I kind of thought that City really actually pummeled them in the first half and really should have been up. And I thought there were two big refereeing decisions, which could have easily gone the other way, certainly with Gallus and the tackle on Zabaleta.
Yeah.
Is that how you saw it?
Yeah. I mean, City play better than they have done in recent games, Gab. I think there's no doubt about that. They're a side that sort of still were frustrated because we're all looking at what we saw last year. I think that's been the surprising factor, that they were so good up until November, December last year, that they frightened the death of people. Two teams, scared the life out of them, and they haven't got to that level this year. I'm so pleased that David Silva was back, because I just think they're a far different team when he's in it. They were the better team, and Tottenham's threats are always with their wide boys. You look at Bale and Lennon, the pace they've got. Bit surprised Defoe didn't play. I mean, he's been on incredible goal scoring run. But I did think that City were the better team on the day.
Roy, I sense a rant coming on, and I devote this to all those people who declared Maicon dead because, was it 2-3 years ago? Gareth Bale has one good game against him, and then he has another chunk of a game Spurs, I believe, were losing 4-0 at the time. Taxi for Maicon. And I looked at on Twitter when he came on, I saw all the more the retweets. And you know what? Maicon, who was a Champions League winner, Maicon, who's not old, Maicon, who is and has been one of the best right backs in the world, he had Mr. Bale in his pocket, I thought, for the rest of the second half. So can all those people go and kiss my ass?
No, I think it's true that one game in the Champions League when you're sort of having a bad night against Tottenham, I think that probably is the defining moment of Maicon's career. I think he probably just thinks about that rather than all the trophies he's won and, you know, winning the treble with Inter and all that. I think he's, you know, probably not fussed about that. He just thinks, Gareth Bale did quite well against me for an hour, and as you say, sort of for 30 minutes when we were 4-0 up and the game was finished. Yeah, I thought Maicon, I don't understand why English football has written off Maicon. He's not as good as he was, I don't think. He's not. His peak was probably, what, 4 or 5 years ago when he was him and Alves were absolutely the best two right backs in the world. Maicon has faded a little bit from that, but although he was pretty good in Serie A last season, I think that's obviously been ignored as well. It doesn't count. It didn't happen here. But I don't understand why there was all the sort of hullabaloo about signing Maicon. He cost £3 million and he took a pay cut to join City. The question with Maicon is that City didn't need another right back. That's the only issue I have with that whole transfer. They didn't need to sign another right back, but he's a good player.
Although, Ollie, in this situation, they kind of moved to three at the back in the second half, and I guess they needed a wing back in that situation, given all their other right backs are injured, and contributed to the win. No.
Oh, he contributed a lot. His introduction, I think, changed the game. I mean, City were, I would say, in the ascendancy when he came on, but his introduction enabled them to switch things and stretch Tottenham more. And Bale was, you know, it was Bale that was the one sort of going backwards and not getting in the game rather than Maicon. And I thought the change suited City perfectly. I mean, it suited Kolarov, it suited Maicon. It freed up Silva a little bit because it meant he could move inside. And I thought that, you know, as much as the Dzeko substitution changed the game. And, you know, I think given all the talk about Mancini's sort of move to 3-5-2 at times this season, I think it's worth him getting some credit for spotting that 4-4-2 wasn't working and for moving away from that to this much maligned system which brought Ward yesterday.
Cass, I want to check this over to you because obviously you've often said about how Andre Villas-Boas is your favourite manager and how he's entirely justified in that Jermaine Defoe should never ever play because he doesn't understand the complicated things that Villas-Boas tells him. Clearly this defeat is entirely Jermaine Defoe's fault and it's got nothing to do with Villas-Boas, right?
No, Villas-Boas to me...
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He's a guy that has to make big decisions because Tottenham are very close to a good side. And he's, you know, I do like some of the signings he's brought to the football club, especially Dembele. I think they're good players, but I look at the way he sets his team up, and a lot of Tottenham fans have been frustrated by certain teams they play against that they feel they should be superior, that they should take advantage of that, and say maybe go 4-4-2. Now, the decision of not playing Jermaine Defoe, and like you touched on, with well, that's tactical and he might not understand it, I don't really understand what a complicated role that would be, because he knows that role. You know, whether it's because it's Man City away, the team were comfortable. They've been comfortable playing that way all season. And I just thought he got it a little bit wrong. You don't need to do a lot wrong in the modern game, as we know. Lots of top games are on an edge. It can go either way. So if you slightly get it wrong, you're going to lose the game. And I thought that was slightly the case against City. Although City were far better than they've been in recent weeks, I still thought Tottenham just didn't quite get it right tactically for me.
Hey, Ollie, can you explain this tactical thing with... Because we had Defoe there, who's not getting younger, and you can call him a super sub or whatever, but it seemed that Villas-Boas, so much is predicated upon bringing Adebayor back. They make the loan permanent, and then we never see Adebayor, practically, certainly not as a starter until recently, and now it's Defoe. Can you shed any light on what's the workings of Villas-Boas' mind when it comes to this point?
Well, I'm guessing that he just didn't think 4-4-2 was the way to go.
No, 4-4-2, 4-4-2 argument. Mm. Sorry, I know some people made that point when you put in one striker for another. I think that's just stupid. Why should he play 4-4-2? Who says it's more?
Exactly.
But just about Adebayor versus Defoe, since he's obviously only going to really play one of them with Dempsey perhaps or Dembele behind. Can you understand why the club would spend a lot of money on Adebayor and then stick with Defoe for the first few months and then make this change now?
Well, it's fair enough from spending a lot of money on what is probably the second striker and one of the two sort of out-and-out strikers in their squad. I mean, if they're only going to play one of them or start with one of them in most matches, then that's one issue. But I don't think starting with one striker should preclude them from having another decent striker on the bench. I think, if anything, they've got too few strikers rather than too many. But I thought Adebayor did well yesterday. The problem I thought Spurs had, apart from some of their defending and the fact they got a little deeper in the second half, was that the three guys behind Adebayor, Lennon, Bale and Dempsey, I thought the three of them were poor.
In today's debate, we discuss issues of race and sexuality, and as part of what we hope is an adult debate, some of the people you will hear don't use the terms like Y-word or N-word, but the actual words. We hope this doesn't offend. It was felt that allowing people to speak out was an essential part of an important conversation. All right. I'd never really heard the name Peter Herbert until very recently, but obviously we've heard that name a lot because he likes to speak to the media a lot of times. He's a lawyer. He's an activist. He, of course, waded into the business with the T-shirts, the Kick It Out T-shirts, and certain players not wearing them. Now he's raised an issue, which I find absolutely fascinating, which is the fact that if you go to White Hart Lane or you watch Tottenham away, you will see a proportion of their fans refer to themselves as the Yids or the Yiddos or the Yid Army. And he's raised the point that this is actually derogatory. And because of the laws that you have in this country where the police have to investigate race-related complaints on the public, he's already said, I believe, November 20th. After that, if he hears a Spurs fan use the term Yid or Yiddo, he will lodge a complaint with the police. Now, some people believe that it's an enormous waste of police time. It should be pointed out that Tottenham have this image as a Jewish club, although, of course, they were founded by a bunch of nice Anglicans at All Hallows Church. But it's one of those things where I don't really see a logical way out or a logical stance. Now, Ollie, I just starting with you, Peter Herbert makes a point that Spurs fans are kind of 40 years behind, and that we just shouldn't have to hear that word at all. And even if you you're self-identifying, it doesn't make a difference. Are you on board with that?
I am broadly. I don't like the word. I have a very distant Jewish background, and that's got nothing to do with it. But I was always led to believe Yid was an offensive word, and I know that Spurs fans have reclaimed it almost, and I know that that has sort of quashed a lot of the chance that they got coming the other way, which showed that in some way it's been successful. But I mean, I don't know, it's such a difficult argument, really. But I mean, instinctively, I feel uncomfortable with it, like I would feel uncomfortable with Chris Rock or somebody like that. So if you're asking me, I don't like it.
Ollie, is one difference that when Chris Rock does it, he is actually reclaiming the word, or he can make that argument because Chris Rock is black. The vast majority of Tottenham fans who sing Yiddo and Yid Army and whatever else, are not Jewish. And so when they're singing engenders sort of this rabid, unpleasant, anti-Semitic response, it might actually affect them in a different way that it might affect a Jewish person who might have had to deal with anti-Semitism.
No, it's quite right. And I mean, isn't there something similar with Ajax and their supporters?
That's right.
And they have done sort of a similar reclaiming almost. And there are all kinds of arguments, and you can't say, well, it's not the same. I'm just saying it's similar. There's a whole load of things that you could say are similar to it, but it doesn't mean that we should all be comfortable with all of them.
I don't buy this argument about reclaiming words with either, because I'm slightly less comfortable with these things than Ollie. I'm going to refer to as the Y word or the N word, on the grounds that they're still offensive if they're used. I grew up in a Jewish part of Leeds, and that word is considered deeply offensive to Jewish people. That said, this is not the way to try and sort of deal with this issue at all. Tottenham fans obviously the majority aren't Jewish. The Jewish roots of the club, I think, might be overplayed to an extent. I think there's other clubs in England, obviously. Ollie's already mentioned Ajax, who've got some kind of Jewish links.
Sorry, if I can jump in on that point, having written about this in our sister paper, the Wall Street Journal, yesterday, and having same owner, close enough, and having read Simon Cooper's excellent book on Ajax, the Dutch of the War, the Ajax situation, and you should read the book or read up on it, because it is fascinating, because that link there is even more tenuous. It's completely non-existent, basically, and it's almost a little bit creepy, given that there were 140,000 Jews living in Holland before the war, and 120,000 of them never came back. So you have a country that actually, you could argue, apart from Poland, lost a higher proportion of its Jewish population than any other country in Europe in the Holocaust, and yet they run around with Jewish colors in a club that was not founded by Jews, had a stadium that many years ago used to be near a Jewish neighborhood, and that is the extent of it. And that I think makes a lot of people uncomfortable. I think it goes well beyond. There's also a high correlation between using the Star of David and whatever in hooliganism and things like that, which isn't the case right now with Tottenham.
No, but I think you probably looked at the roots of the association. It's probably the same. So Spurs fans chant, call themselves Yid Army and what have you, because years ago, I presume, that chant was hurled at them in a negative connotation. That would be logical. Mm. So they reclaimed the word. But reclaiming that word doesn't work, because it is still offensive if it's just as a white person can't call a black person the N-word, despite rappers and Chris Rock and whoever reclaiming it for 20 years. It doesn't work. It's kind of a flawed argument. But the problem, that's kind of detracting a little bit from what Peter Herbert's doing, which is taking something that's not meant in a racial context. The non-Jewish Spurs fans chanting Yid Army are not being racist. I guess the problem is that it does that prompt racism. That's the question.
That's the problem.
But reporting those Spurs fans to the police is not, by some sort of weird proxy incitement of racial hatred, is not the solution. It's kind of causing more of a problem than it is aiding the situation, I guess.
You're arguing that Peter Herbert should sneak into White Hart Lane and perhaps not report the people who sing Yid Army, but report the people who respond with those Cyclone B hissing noises.
Yeah, although they're not quite as common, I think, as
Peter Herbert believes.
I've heard them before, but you hear them very rarely. Ollie's been down to Spurs probably for longer than I have, but yeah, they're not sort of... It's not every week that you hear them.
Ollie, who lives in the north of England. Cass, your take on this. I mean, obviously you grew up in the southeast of England. is this, are you down, and obviously you've got, how can I say this, issues of identity? do you buy this sort of self, you know, did you buy this sort of self-empowerment? I mean...
Gab, I find it, I think like us all, we all walk on eggshells talking about it. We find it difficult to understand. I've listened to Rory there about reclaiming words, and I grew up with Paul Elliott. I knew Paul since I was about 11, and we played together at Chelsea, and now he works for the FA, obviously tackling racism. And I remember sitting at a table one day having a chat with Paul and just saying about the N-word, that, you know, that black people, you know, will say it, and he then explained to me why it was okay. And I said, I didn't understand it. I said, I can't understand. If it's a derogatory word and it's an offensive word, why is it okay? And, you know, explained all due to the slavery and everything. So I think we all get caught up in, we're not quite sure how we stand, or what's right and what's wrong. I just feel if something is wrong, like you said, the Y word and like the M word, if it's wrong and offensive, why can anybody use it? I don't get it. I get lost in it. And I think we all tend to shy away from, you know, from the bare facts for me are, come on, let's do this together and let's understand it all together. We're all in it. If we want to fight racism and offensive things, we have to all be singing off the same hymn sheet, which we are totally, I don't think we're not. That's part of the problem.
You guys seem to have this issue with empowerment and the N-word. I can give you one example where perhaps a word has been almost entirely robbed of its derogatory connotations precisely because it was reclaimed, and the obvious is the term queer, which, you know, is maybe it's not being, I mean, you're always making a face because maybe it's that word makes him a bit uncomfortable, but among the LGBT community, certainly having... They use the word queer increasingly, and as a means of self-identifying, and that word's people make that argument.
That's fine, and I get that, and the argument can be made with the N-word as well. If someone says the word queer in a homophobic context, in a homophobic way, it is still offensive. I've heard people use the word queer in a context that I would consider offensive to gay people.
Right, but then you can use the word homosexual in the context that's offensive to gay people.
That's
too.
Much harder to use the word homosexual in a sort of in an offensive way. Except with you're a homosexual. Do you know what I mean? That's not offensive. Queer is a loaded term to me. I know what you're saying, and I'm not necessarily saying you're wrong, but these are all loaded terms. The question surely has to be for Peter Herbert or whoever. Are they being used in a loaded way?
I'm just going to leave you guys with this thought to wrap this up. The one thing that makes me uncomfortable about Tottenham's reaction, the reaction of Tottenham fans, is pretty much the same thing that makes me uncomfortable when a whole bunch of old white heterosexual men decide what a woman should do with her body and her reproductive rights. And that is the fact that I don't know that Jewish Tottenham, the Tottenham fans who are Jewish, who are directly impacted by this. I don't know to what degree they've been broadly consulted and to what degree they're sort of might feel pressure to go along with this because this is the way it's always been. And look at it, isn't it funny? And we're the Yates and tee-hee-hee. All right, time now for some quick hits. Liverpool grab a point at Stamford Bridge. But Rory, that looked like a pretty obvious shove by your friend Luis Suarez on Ramirez for his equalizer. Would you rather talk about Suarez's continued cheating and embarrassment or how maybe a referee behind the goal might have actually spotted it since evidently Howard Webb was looking elsewhere?
Yeah, I think Howard Webb was looking at Jamie Carragher's header to set up the chance for Suarez. It was a push, no question about that. A little bit of
cheating.
Penalty box cunning, I think is how I would prefer to cast it. He played very well. Suarez probably deserved the goal. Yeah, there's no question that in that circumstance, an assistant referee behind the goal line would have spotted it and would have ruled the goal out, no question. That's why it's quite a good idea. Those assistants do more good than harm.
Thank you. My sentiments exactly. Great day for Olivier Giroud. Horrible day for Mikel Arteta. 3 goals scored, but 3 goals conceded for Arsene Wenger. Ollie, this one's real easy. Is Arsenal's glass half full or half empty? And if it's empty, how empty is it?
The Arsenal situation can never be adequately summed up by, you know, a phrase such as half full or half empty. Is it black or is it white? There are huge grey areas at Arsenal. They are a decent team that is rebuilding it again after losing players that they shouldn't have lost. They're not bad, but they are 11 points off the top. They're well short of top four form at the moment. They need to improve. Saturday just underlined a lot of the frailties that we've seen over the last few seasons. They're not in a terrible place. They're doing all right under certain circumstances, but they need to be better.
Staying at the Emirates, Dimitar Berbatov looked impressive once again. Cass, might he be the signing of the summer, apart from Jakob, of course? Or is it the Arsenal defence that's actually quite rubbish?
Well, he's certainly given a new dimension to Fulham. And taking a guy at his age who doesn't rely on pace, who's got an incredibly gifted brain about playing football and is a cool and collective figure on the pitch, he's added a lot. I thought Ruiz as well for Fulham has done brilliant since he's come. And I thought it was great business by Martin Yeo. And you consider £4 million. It's a player that I think should be at a top four club. When he left United, I couldn't believe none of the other major clubs didn't try to get Dimitar Berbatov.
West Ham went away at Newcastle, and hey, presto, they're right up near the Champions League. Rory, you're a huge fan of Sam Allardyce and his methods. Any deeper meaning to the fact that the Hammers are flying so high?
I think there is. I think they're one of very few teams in the Premier League who can defend, and I include all the top sides in that. I think what Allardyce, this is just a normal Allardyce team with all the usual sort of flaws and positives and negatives and failings and all that. They're not particularly great to watch. They're not exactly exciting or beautiful or aesthetic. Pleasing, but they can defend. They're solid. They don't ship many goals. They're well organised at the back, and that in this league, and to be honest, across most of Europe, is pretty rare at the moment. A lot of teams are struggling with the sort of new rules on outlawing tackling, and Allardyce's side aren't. They can defend, and that's why they're sixth. They won't stay there, but yeah, they'll finish, I would guess, possibly top 10.
Top 10 for West Ham. Well done, Big Sam. It's now 6 games unbeaten for Everton, and they just won't go away. Ollie, here's a broader question for you. Moyes recognized that they were a bit lucky in their 2-1 win over Sunderland. Does the fact that Everton, and for that matter, West Brom, are so high up the table suggest that maybe some of the highly paid managers who look after wealthier clubs with bigger wage bills really aren't that good? And don't worry, I won't make you name names.
Well, I mean, if you are talking about the managers of Spurs, Arsenal, Liverpool, then all three of those clubs are having some early season teething problems with a lot of people over the summer.
And I'm talking about the managers, Sunderland, QPR, teams like that.
Well, in terms of more highly paid managers, I think Moyes is up there with those managers in terms of how he should, of course, be paid a lot more than them. And he's got a situation now where he's in the final year of his contract and is about to negotiate a new one, Everton fans have. But I think rather than dwell on how poorly other teams are doing, I prefer to praise Moyes for what he does, because I think Tony Evans gets it absolutely spot on in his column in the Times this morning. I think Moyes has worked absolute wonders at Everton. No, there hasn't been a trophy. Yes, they've only got into the top four once and never quite into the Champions League, but they are a team that consistently performs at very least two and often beyond expectations.
Anything? Well, my feelings for David Moyes, of course, are public knowledge. We are nearly lovers. Speaking of West Brom, they've kind of snuck up on us. What's Steve Clarke doing right? And obviously, it's not really all down to Jakob bossing the midfield, but it is a big part of it. I mean, do you get it, Cass? McCauley, Olsen, this great defensive partnership. Where is this all coming from?
Well, I think first and foremost, Gab, I think when Steve Clarke walked into the club, he didn't do a big upheaval. You know, he knew he had the pace of Odemwingie, along. He's got people like Dorans in midfield, Gira, good footballers, can get you a goal, be creative. And I think he just kept it, you know, from what Roy Hodgson had started and sort of has tried to add slightly to that. I mean, it was their first away win this season, which was a big plus for them. They were a very, very good home side, West Brom, and they put in some good performances. And I think Steve Clarke's just been an intelligent guy, knowing not to change too much too quickly. And that's been the most impressive thing for for me.
One for you. Lazio won the Rome derby on Sunday, and Daniele De Rossi got himself sent off in the silliest of ways. Did a screw come loose?
I fear it did. It was basically toward the end of the first half. It was 2-1. It was a downpour of monsoon-like conditions, but Roma still in it. And he just goes and punches Stefano Mauri in the face on a corner kick. I actually suspect, or it was a set piece actually, I actually suspect that he figured he had a way of doing it in like a sneaky Uruguayan sort of way with that, but then he forgot that there was a referee behind the goal. But lots of questions. He's going to face a long ban now. Roma, of course, went on to lose that game 3-2. And of course, given his contract situation and his relationship with Zdeněk Zeman, there's going to be a lot of people speculating already that he might have played his last game for Roma. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts or email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. Remember, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, our web chats. Rory's is on Monday, so unfortunately, you'll probably have to wait till next week to catch him. Same goes for Rory's blog, which is also Mondays. Ollie K doesn't have a blog, but that's okay because you can find him in the paper most days. And of course, Cass's excellent column is in the game on Mondays, probably the second biggest reason to read the game every Monday. Till next time, bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts. Calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.